Where were we?
Oh, well, the fire alarm's now going off.
Well, at least you missed that last night.
Yeah, there wasn't any. Well, there are two of them. I'll let them pass before I start.
Maybe it did go off last night and I just didn't hear it because I was sleeping very, very soundly.
Yeah, I heard one siren earlier. Oh,
really?
But, I mean, I was awake by that point, so I did wake up pretty early. But I can tell you what the question is.
What's
that? There's so many of these little alarms, are there?
I think they do it five times. Five or six.
So the question is about your name. I would be interested to hear, because your first name is...
Dorothy.
And so...
Well, I started off life as Dorothy Ann Rankin. And then my parents thought that was kind of a blah name. Dorothy was my mother's name. And so they decided on the battle name, and that was my mother's name was her family. She was Tempe Battle. And that family actually had six girls and one boy. And the son never married, so there were no battles carrying on the name. And I guess that's one reason my mother, probably to honor her mother and her mother's family, picked Battle. And for a long time, I was called Dorothy Battle by the double name, which was a tradition in the South. And then when my brother came along, he could not manage Dorothy Battle. And so he just started calling me Battle because it was easier to say than Dorothy. And so it just stuck. And at various times in my life, I've tried to change it. And it just hadn't taken. So finally, I just decided, it's my name. I'm going to be proud of it. It's a distinguished Southern name. I should be proud of it and go with it. And that's what I've done. And I answer many questions about how I got that name. People are astounded by it. Down south, it didn't matter so much because people had heard of the family. But up in this part of the country, they've never heard the name even as a surname. Mm-hmm. Or very rarely would have heard it as a surname. So they don't even know where I got it. In the south, they would know where I got the name, I think. Because it's a southern family.
Right. A lot of sirens.
It's going that way. It's an ambulance.
And has that affected, I imagine in law school people would pick up on that, and it's a unique name that I think that people would remember.
I don't remember so much in law school. People do remember it, and I may say that is a very good thing about it. Because it is a memorable name and people remember it, and I know they tell stories about it and everything else, but I don't think it's hurt me to have an unusual name like that at all. Obviously, when you're younger, you're more sensitive about things like that, and it took me a while to just get used to explaining it and spelling it. And not apologizing for it or anything. I can't remember people. You know, it's funny. I just can't remember people in law school making fun of it or anything. Once I got into the practice of law and I was writing briefs, I mean, people would say, boy, what a great name to put on a brief. So they would joke around about it like that. But I don't remember people being mean or unkind about it. But it is a distinctive name. People do remember it. And I guess on balance, I would say it's been more help than hindrance.
Yeah. I mean, with the name of Jane, it's very... there are five Janes in our class, at law school. Uh-huh. So, I mean, one of many.
Yeah, well, there was a Jane in my class, Jane Noble. Mm-hmm. Was in my class at law school, so...
It's a classic name. It's gone, I think my parents really liked it for mm-hmm. its simplicity, perhaps.
Yeah.
It's hard to stand out. I can see the flip side of the coin is, you know, having a first name of Battle is being very able to kind of be remembered.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, to be used to your advantage.
I think once I learned to do that, I think it was, as I said, more help than hindrance. But it's no doubt it's a very unusual name. I actually have known several other people named Battle. And it's interesting, at Duke, there was a guy in the class ahead of me whose name was Battle Robinson. My name was not Battle Robinson at that time. It was Battle Rankin. But they've ended up with two Battle Robinsons, one male, one female, at the same era at Duke. And then a few years ago, I went to a party for women who were running for office. And I met a woman, I think she was from Maryland somewhere. And she said, I have a 13-year-old daughter named Battle. And they called her Battle. Her name, I think, was Cordelia Battle. I don't know what her last name was. So that was another time when somebody was named Battle. And then I remember a sorority sister whose name was Battle at the University of Alabama. And so I run across the name occasionally that people use it as a first name. But it is rare.
And you chose to name your daughter Dorothy. Mm-hmm. Is that also a family name, Dorothy?
It was just my mother's name, and, you know, I'm not sure. I think my mother's older brother named her Dorothy, and I've always thought it was because it was from The Wizard of Oz, which had come out at about the time of my mother's birth, and I think my uncle loved the name Dorothy, and that's how my mother was named Dorothy. And I was named Dorothy, and I named my daughter Dorothy just because I honored and respected my mother so much that I just wanted my daughter to have her name. And that's an unusual name now, Dorothy. You know, there are not many Dorothys out there that are her age. So.
That's true. I don't know any Dorothys.
Mm-hmm.
Great. So I wanted to, that was one question that
right.
was sticking out kind of on, yeah. on its own. Mm-hmm. So the Department of Justice. You start working in D.C. In 1963.
In the fall of 1963. I think I actually went there in November of 1963. I can't remember why I put it off so long, except I don't know whether it was something about the vacancies at the Department of Justice or whether I traveled that summer. I just can't remember because it seems unusual that I would have waited so long. After graduating in June, I guess, wait till November to start work. But that's what happened. And I was joined the Civil Rights Division. And the interesting thing was, when I joined the Civil Rights Division, I assumed I would be traveling in the South and handling cases in the South. Wrong. I was put in the appellate section. Because they had no women at that point working as attorneys in the trial section because they thought it was too dangerous for women to be traveling in the South at that point, ignoring the fact that I had spent all my life living in the South. But anyway, so I went into the appeals and research section, and there were like 7 attorneys in that section, I think, at the time I joined it. And we had very little space, and I was stuck in this tiny office with 2 other lawyers. The office housed 3 of us in very cramped quarters, plus the division library, which went down kind of a hallway that ran to a door that entered our office. So it was a very crowded spot. But I was in there with 2 of the best lawyers I've ever known, Howard Glickstein and David Rubin. And they had just finished working on the Baker versus Carr brief for the Supreme Court. They had worked on all sorts of very important appellate briefs in the civil rights area. And they were just wonderful. They were just pleasant to work with and so smart. And I was just, they are still 2 of my dearest friends and most respected people that I've ever known. And they were really unhappy when I moved in there and crowded their space. But they got used to me and we became very, very good friends. And I worked with them during the time I was in the appellate section. And then the boss of that section was Harold Green, who went on to become a judge in the Court of General Sessions and then head of the Superior Court, I guess, in the District of Columbia, and then onto the federal bench. And he handled the telephone, the AT&T breakup. Oh, my memory is failing me. I think I'm tired after lunch. And it was a big antitrust case. And he came from Civil Rights Division. That was his background. And I remember talking with him. I said, Harold, it's wonderful you're going to be handling that. But I said, I didn't know you knew anything about antitrust law. And I remember him saying, oh, I don't know anything about antitrust law. He said, but if you are a good lawyer, you ought to be able to handle anything that's thrown at you. And he went on to become very well known for his decision in that case. And when I was sworn in, he came over and swore me into the bench in Delaware. Because the seven of us working in that little unit were very close and very good friends. And he was just a superb lawyer and a wonderful boss and very helpful in guiding and rewriting, because I'd never written an appellate brief, and there I was writing appellate briefs for the Circuit Courts of Appeals, and then I worked on United States versus Mississippi in the Supreme Court, and a lot of major litigation, and I was basically doing research and some writing. And that was just a wonderful experience. I guess looking back on it, that was kind of the best legal experience I had in my life. I really enjoyed the time I was there because I enjoyed the people so much, and we were very close, and we worked on a lot of important cases. And recently I read Nicholas Katzenbach's book called, has a great title. It was called Some of It Was Fun. And it was a lot about his, the time he was the Attorney General and the Department of Justice under his leadership. And he talks in there about the work that the Appeals and Research Section did on a lot of major cases, and especially on the legislative history for the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We did a lot of the research for that, prepared statements for the congressmen and the senators. So that was very interesting. Although I was a little shocked that the Justice Department, which was going to be arguing these cases in court, was having any input whatsoever into the legislative history. But I guess that's the way it works in Washington. But that was very interesting. Anyway, he gave a lot of credit to that section because most of the drama in the section went to the trial staff, which was actually going into the South and trying cases in the South. And of course, that's where all the violence was. So the press was very focused on what the trial unit at the Civil Rights Division was doing instead of what the Appeals and Research Section was doing. So it meant a lot to me that Katzenbach appreciated what we had done and mentioned it and praised us in his book. That was a very satisfying thing for me to read after the years I spent on that. But then after couple of years, I can't remember how many, in the appellate section, they finally decided, I asked for a transfer to the trial section, and they granted it. And so I went over and started working in the trial section of the Civil Rights Division, and that's when I spent some time in the South. And I actually lived in Mississippi for a year and ran the little office we had in Jackson, which mainly meant checking on, you know, what was going on in the courts down there and who was coming to argue the cases and maybe doing some depositions. I didn't get into court very much, but I handled a lot of the office kind of things. That was an interesting experience. And I traveled around the state some. A lot of what I did was go with the FBI to photograph voting records in the counties, because much to my surprise, when I got to the Justice Department, I learned that we weren't going to win a case by going into court and saying it's unfair to keep people from voting. You had to prove it. So that meant going through all these lists of voters and you know, showing how many were black and how many blacks had had their applications denied and for what reason. And so that was, it was a lot of long, tedious discovery work that we did. And so a lot of the travel in the South was just going to the into the various counties and going into the voting records and then going out and talking to black people who had maybe tried to register to vote or who had registered to vote or, you know, after a long struggle. So that was the kind of thing I did with the Justice Department in Mississippi.
How long were you living in Mississippi?
You know, I'm not sure. I think I was there a year, maybe a year and a half, mm-hmm. and traveling around. And my most exciting story from Mississippi was when I had been traveling on the Delta. I remember I had been going out. I was by myself this time, and I was going out to interview. And right now I can't remember if I was interviewing the voting registrar, the circuit court clerk, or if I was going out to interview some potential black witnesses. And we had to call in. We didn't have cell phones or GPS or anything at that point. And we had to call in every couple of hours to the Justice Department so they would know we were okay. And so I was way out in this rural area, and I could not find a place. And, of course, in those days, we had to use payphones. And I was way out in the country, and I finally saw this gas station that had a payphone out front. So I went in and put my money in, and I got an operator. And I told her I was putting this call into the Justice Department in Washington. And the operator said to me, "Honey, if you're with the Justice Department, you better get out of that place you're in." And I just thought that was the most amazing thing. And I said, "Thank you very much," and hung up and went and drove away and found another phone. So that was probably the only time that I ever felt, you know, threatened at all. And I wasn't really threatened. It was just that she gave me a warning, the local operator, which I appreciated.
Yeah, it was for your own safety. Was that what the idea that you got from that?
I got the idea that it was for my own safety, that I was in a very dangerous, that rural gas station was not a good place for a civil rights worker to be. And she was good enough to warn me about it. That's what I took the conversation to be, because I soon left. But that was about the most exciting thing that happened. I guess there were other times, you know, we were not very welcome, but on the other hand, there were many, many good people. There were many wonderful black people that we met who appreciated what we were doing, and there were many wonderful white people who wanted to see this system ended and were doing what they could and would be cordial to us. I don't know what else to say about that.
Yeah.
But I did that for a couple of years. Then I went back to Washington, and at that point I was headed up the Florida unit for the Civil Rights Division, and so we did all these cases in Florida. We did a lot of school desegregation cases and some employment discrimination cases, voting discrimination cases, a lot of Title IV work, which was the public accommodations work, and they were just plain old, and we would send the FBI out to investigate, and then we would write letters demanding compliance, and a lot of times we would get agreement with it, and sometimes it went into court. And maybe 10 years ago, a gal who had been in my class at Yale, Virginia Fenton, who was living in Florida, sent me an article in the paper about the Lee County school desegregation case. And she said, "Your case still goes on." It was still before the courts. I mean, it was, 20, 30 years after I'd left the Justice Department. And I guess the school desegregation issues were still before the court in Lee County, Florida. So that was very interesting. One interesting thing that happened to me when I was working in Florida, I was down in the Northern District of Florida, and I was before Judge Carswell, and to argue some kind of motion. I thought it was a relatively minor motion. And who should show up but the governor of Florida, to make an argument on the other side. There I was representing the majesty of the United States, and Governor Eckert was in the courtroom to argue before Judge Carswell. And so that was kind of exciting when that happened. And then, but Judge Carswell was always very nice to me. He had actually gone to Duke Law School. So he was always very, very polite to me. And then later he was nominated by Nixon to the Supreme Court. And I had a difference of opinion with most of the people in the Civil Rights Division because they were very opposed to this nomination, thinking that Carswell was very racist. I think I felt that Nixon was the president and he had the authority to nominate to the Supreme Court, and that my experience before Judge Carswell was not all that horrible. So anyway, I had a difference of opinion with the division on that appointment. And it wasn't too long after that that I left the division. I got married and moved to Delaware.
So going back to your early days, you mentioned how you had been working for 2 weeks before the assassination of JFK. I was wondering how that rippled through.
Oh, we were sitting in that little crowded office. I'd been there 2 weeks. And Dave Rubin's wife called and said, the president's been shot. And we raced upstairs, up in the, across from the Attorney General's office. There was a ticker tape. That's how the news came out in those days. The Associated Press had a ticker tape up there. So we went running up there to see what the ticker tape was saying. And I remember we got up there and they had these huge metal doors outside of the Attorney General's office. And they had shut those. They just clanged, you know, they just shut those. We later learned that the Attorney General wasn't, that was Bobby Kennedy was the Attorney General. And we later learned he wasn't there. But at the time we thought, oh my gosh, what's going on? They're, you know, protecting Bobby Kennedy. What's happening? But that's how we learned about Kennedy's assassination. And the what I remember about that is the feeling that so many people had when he went to Texas that something terrible was going to happen. And of course everybody thought it was going to be from a right-wing crazy. Turned out to be from a left-wing crazy. But I think, you know, everybody thought, oh no, it's, you know, it's happened. And everybody thought at that time, at least the people in the Civil Rights Division, that it had come from the right wing. And, I mean, it was just very distressing. And then I remember walking home that day. I guess they shut down the Justice Department. But I remember I walked all the way from the Justice Department to my house in Georgetown just to kind of, you know, just deal with it, to have some time to think. I remember walking by the White House and on to Georgetown. I just remember that very, very vividly. I mean, that was an amazing thing that happened in my lifetime. And I'm trying to remember, because then the Warren Commission started working and I was still in D.C. I had some friends that worked for the Warren Commission, so it was interesting, you know, following what they were thinking and what they were doing. I don't know. I was not in D.C. for the president's funeral. I watched it on television. I went down to North Carolina and stayed with my family and then went back to work the next week. But that was just a horrible, horrible time for the country. Just to think that could happen. And now it just seems like it's happened so much. You know, it started something. It just started a wave of violence and terrible stuff.
Did you feel any effects in the work of the Civil Rights Division, or perhaps see his assassination as in some way challenging the policies, the civil rights policies of the country?
I don't think so, no. If anything, I don't think it did have anything to do with challenging the civil rights. I mean, that's what we all thought it would be, but I don't think it was. And I don't think it stopped the department, and it certainly didn't stop Lyndon Johnson. He was much more effective in the civil rights area than Kennedy had been, in my judgment. You know, I think he did great work in this country for the civil rights movement. What else can I say? Thinking about back all this is kind of emotional.
If you want to take a break at any
time. No, I'm okay.
I had been doing some reading about the Mississippi burning trials, and I know that I think it was in 1964 when the three civil rights workers were killed in Mississippi, and you were at the civil rights division. Mm-hmm.
I was still in the appellate section, but I did go to Mississippi then because we did a lot of background work looking into the background of the people who were on the jury panel, which I might say that's something the government can afford to do that private defense counsel cannot, and probably makes a difference. And it bothers me a little bit. I don't know that I think that's really fair when you think about getting a fair trial. But, you know, you have to be prepared, and you want to know something about the background of the jurors so you will know if they have affiliations with the Klan or anything like that. And so I did some work on that with those trials, but I was not otherwise involved in that. John Doerr handled that. And it's funny because a couple of years ago we had a reunion of the Civil Rights Division people, and there was a lot of discussion of that that trial. And we heard from the government lawyers, and then we had people play the role of the lawyers on the other side. And that was a very interesting experience to see the, you know, how the lawyers approached it and handled that case. But I was not directly involved.
Did it cause a bit of a stir in the office, though? When reading, it sounded like there, for the same reason that you had to call into the office every 2 hours when you weren't, you know, going out in Mississippi. I imagine that the news kind of spread pretty quickly.
Yeah, well, it could be. I don't really remember the news of the murders spreading quickly. I just don't remember that like I do the Kennedy assassination. I remember that very vividly. I don't remember that. But honestly, Jane, we heard stuff like this all the time. I mean, terrible incidents that were happening. And recently, when I was going through some of my papers in the attic, which I hadn't looked at for years and years and years, I came across all these answers to people's letters that, among the other things we did in the Florida unit, we would get a letter from somebody saying I was discriminated against or whatever. And I mean, there were just hundreds of these letters coming in, and most of them we would write back and say, you know, we've considered it, but we don't believe there was a violation of the civil rights law, or we would just brush them off. And I know these people, that these were people who really cared, you know, and really felt bad. Now, occasionally there would be something, and we would ask the FBI to go out and interview and maybe do a report. And occasionally something would turn up that we would bring a lawsuit about. But so many people, we just wrote these letters saying, the president appreciates your concern, and but she didn't know he's worried about your situation or something like that without doing anything. And I thought, this is terrible. We were doing this every day, just sending out letters like this. But, you know, you don't have all the resources in the world. You just do what you have to do. But that kind of, I hadn't thought about that till I came across all these letters that are now sitting in my attic. They were the letters that we sent out, because as head of the Florida unit, I got a copy of every single letter that went out from every attorney, and I had never been through them, so I had a huge box of them. So, and they're still there, and I may turn them over to a library someday, because I think people would be amazed at how the kinds of things citizens were writing us about.
How many attorneys were in the Florida division under you?
One, two, probably four. It's a big state, not many attorneys. And we did some major school desegregation work in Hillsborough County, Lee County, Broward County, Duval County, just so many. What's the one where Pensacola is? All over on the panhandle. We did a lot of school desegregation. The voting wasn't too bad in Florida. So most of what we did there was school desegregation and public accommodations, as I recall. And a couple of big employment discrimination cases. Jacksonville Terminal Company. And I think there was another one. And a lot of those I wasn't directly involved in, but they were handled by attorneys in the section I was head of. So I followed that litigation. So.
And how long were you in Florida for?
I don't remember. I was with the Justice Department 7 years. So I was probably 2 years in the appellate section, maybe three. A couple of years a year and a half in Mississippi, and the rest of the time I was back in D.C. in the Florida, in the trial unit, in the Florida unit. They changed the organization of that division around a lot. Mm-hmm. I think by the time I left, as I'm recalling, they had divided us up by subject matter. So there was an employment section and a housing section and a voting section and a school section. But, or at least part of the time I was there, they were sort of by states. So there were Alabama, Florida, Mississippi, Georgia. Mm-hmm. I did some work in North Carolina too, but mostly Florida.
And was your, was the job that you were doing, I imagine it was, but perhaps it's better to ask how it was affected by who the president or vice president was, who the attorney general was?
I think it was very affected by politics. It was Kennedy and then Johnson. And I would say while Johnson was there, that was just the high watermark of the civil rights movement. And that's when the Civil Rights Act passed, and he got that passed. And there was a lot of litigation, a lot of successful litigation. And then, of course, after Johnson came Nixon, and he made efforts to scale it back. To not entirely, because they were still, you know, bringing lawsuits, but it was affected politically, I think, by the fact the Republicans and by Nixon came into office. I mean, they changed the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights changed, and of course the Attorney General changed, and I think they made an effort to, I won't say they tried to scale it back, but maybe less emphasis on it would be a more proper way to say it than had been the case under Johnson. So, yeah, it was definitely changed. And I left, when did I leave? 70. So it was not long after Nixon had not, I can't remember. Can't remember who was elected when. I guess Nixon had been elected in 68 and I left in 70 and got married. And everybody laughs about this. We got married in a very small ceremony in my parents' house in North Carolina because I didn't want a big fancy wedding. And they had just married us. I mean, the wedding was just over and the telephone rang. And it was the Civil Rights Division calling to ask me where some file was. I've always remembered that. I hadn't been married more than a minute and they were calling to see where I'd put some file or something. And I think I had left by then, but you know how it is when you leave. There's still a lot of stuff that needs to be wrapped up, and they didn't know where things were. So that was probably my last official act with the Justice Department, was telling them where to find that file. So I remember that. And anyway, I was then, how old was I? In 1970, I was 32. And I think I was ready at that point to settle down. And I had been dating Robert for a long time, maybe 8 years. We'd known one another. And it just worked out that we finally decided to get married. And we always joke and say it was because he was tired of driving to Washington and I was tired of driving to the beach so we could see each other on weekends. So we decided we might as well get married. But it was a big change, you know, to leave Washington and leave all that and come over here. And I remember it was a, sort of a hard decision for me. My father kept telling, he was the one who said, you ought to get married. But he kept telling me, Battle, don't worry. He said, if you have any ability at all, people are going to find out about it, wherever you are. So don't worry too much about that. And I remember one day I was seated outside at a cafe in Washington. And these people came by, I don't know, I guess they were from a Middle Eastern country in robes and everything. And I thought, oh, I can't leave Washington because of all these interesting people. And I'll just be stuck over there in this rural area. And then it occurred to me, I don't know whether these people are interesting or not. They may be total bores. And why am I saying that? Just because I see them in an exotic attire that I have to stay in Washington. So I remember when that thought hit me. And then another time, Robert called and said he couldn't come over to Washington because a friend of his had died. And I said, oh, that's terrible, you know. I said, how old was he? And Barbara said, oh, he was 88. And I thought that was just kind of so cool that he was talking about this friend who was just an older person. And that kind of impressed me, too. And I thought, well, you know, maybe small-town life wouldn't be so bad after all. And so here I am. Been here ever since.
How did you meet Robert?
He actually went to the University of North Carolina while I was at Duke, but I did not meet him there. A close friend of mine at Duke was from Georgetown, Delaware. She went to Virginia Beach to teach after graduating from Duke. I was at the Yale Law School then, and driving back to North Carolina in the summer, I stopped by Virginia Beach to see her, and she got me a date with Robert, and that's how I met him. He was from Georgetown. He had known her, and we went out. We've always remembered this. We went to a bar, and we heard a music group called the Big Three perform. They were pretty good, and they later became the Mamas and the Papas, and we heard them before they became famous. So that was kind of fun. And then we dated for about, you know, 8 years, the whole time I was at the Justice Department. And I dated other people. I saw other people. I had a couple of rather serious romances. And just finally worked out. I married Robert. So that's how I got to Delaware.
And it's your first time, it was your first time living in a small town.
It was my first time living in a small town. I had grown up in a university community in Durham. And I think I miss that more than I miss a big city. Just the variety of people you meet in a university community and everything that's going on. And I miss that a lot. And my father had grown up in a small town, so I had heard all these stories. He would tell a good story about, you know, all these people in this small town. It was like a novel or something. And so I always thought, well, that sounds kind of cool. You know, that sounds kind of neat to be in this small town. So I think maybe that helped me to make a transition to a small town. But I'm sure I was insufferable when I first came here and thought I knew everything and so much smarter than everybody else in town and with my Yale degree and blah, blah, blah. So it took me a while to settle in, but I've done it.
It feels like a nice a nice speed. Mm-hmm. But I mean, at the same time, it's a nice speed, and you were working very, very hard and long hours at Family Court, at least.
I was, and I stayed very busy when I was here. The first job I had, I worked for the Delaware Legislature, and that involved driving to and from Dover. And I really enjoyed that work. That was very interesting work. I grew up in North Carolina. I was a Democrat. I was a Democrat in D.C. When I came to Delaware, I registered as an independent. Robert was a Republican, and his newspaper had a printing company connected with it. And they printed all the legislative journals from the Delaware General Assembly. And because of that, he got to know the clerk of the House, whose name was Twinkie Smith. And at that time, the Delaware legislature was in Republican control. She heard he had married a woman lawyer. She wanted a woman lawyer to work as an attorney for the House of Representatives. And when a vacancy became available, she maneuvered and got me the job working for the Delaware legislature. And that was extremely interesting. I gave legal advice to legislators, and I drafted legislation, which is one of the things I've enjoyed doing a lot in my career, is the actual drafting of legislation. And so I had a good couple of years there. And it was interesting. At that point, there were three attorneys. Two were Republican, one was Democrat. And we were in one office all together. And that's not the case now. They are separated. The Republican attorneys are with the Republican caucus. The Democratic attorney is with the Democratic caucus. And, you know, we helped each other. That was bipartisanship. We helped each other a lot, you know, with each other's questions about things. So I did that for a couple of years. And I loved that job. And then Rob was born. And I took off for a few months. He was born in May, but I guess the next January I went back to work for the legislature. And then in 76, Pete DuPont was running for governor, was elected governor. Robert had worked on his campaign. He was elected, and he asked me to join his staff. And so I did that. And I worked for him the whole time he was governor. 8 years. Could that possibly be right? I can't remember right now. I was his assistant legal counsel, and that involved drafting legislation. It involved reviewing all the bills that came through the General Assembly and making recommendations to the governor about whether or not he should sign them. I reviewed extraditions, commutations, and pardons from the Board of Pardons, just a whole variety of different kinds of legal things that I had ever worked on before, and very specialized work. Only someone who's worked in the governor's office would really know about this kind of thing. So that was a very interesting job. I enjoyed that a lot. Again, I was working only 3 days a week, and I would drive to Dover those 3 days, and I, you know, had to get to know the staff in the House and the Senate, and I went to meetings in Governor DuPont's office and worked some with lobbyists about legislation, just the whole smear of things that gets done in state legislatures in this country. And it had a tremendous impact on me because I learned that states are capable of doing things. The federal government does not have to do everything. And it's maybe not a good idea to have the federal government do everything, because things are very different in different states. And that sometimes the legislatures of states and the governors are perfectly capable of making these decisions and carrying these things out. That was kind of a revelation to me, because as I've told you earlier, I wanted to work for the federal government and I was a committed Democrat, and the fact that I became convinced that the people that were working for the state were capable. It was a turning point for me politically, I think. And I had a lot of admiration for Governor DuPont. He was a terrific governor and a good guy, smart guy. What else can I tell you? I'm just going on and on and on and on and on.
Well, this is, you know, what we're interested to hear.
So that was my career in the state government. And we did everything, you know. We took complaints and phone calls from people. I remember when I went out to have my daughter, I was working in the governor's office when Dorothy was born. And they gave me a little party. And my secretary said, Miss Robinson, when you're in the hospital, would you check in the nursery? She said, I think there's a sign on the wall that says, in this life, if you have any problems, call the governor. She said, all the babies are picking that up somewhere, and it must be a sign in the nursery to do that. So I always remembered that, because we just dealt with everything, as you can imagine. Because people do. They just call the governor. And so, I mean, he had people on the staff that handle citizen constituent issues. But a lot of times we got drawn into it because sometimes there were legal questions. But I enjoyed that work a lot.
I was going to ask about your political development, your development the development of your political philosophy. I know you mentioned, I mean, it doesn't seem that much of what you did in law school or even at the Department of Justice was very partisan in a way, but that eventually you became, you know, very much affiliated with the Republican Party here in Delaware.
Mm-hmm, I did. And, I was working with the Civil Rights Division, and everybody was liberal, and Lyndon Johnson was very liberal in the whole country. And I don't think I'm sure there were conservatives out there objecting to all this, but I did not come in contact with them. The only people I came in contact were people who were much more liberal than the lawyers in the Civil Rights Division, who kept thinking we should do so much more. I mean, we were fending off all sorts of attacks from the left who thought we weren't doing as much as we should be. I was a committed Democrat. I was committed to the federal government. I felt the federal government, that's what I had wanted my career to be. And then when I made this change and came and lived in a small town, first of all, there's not much federal presence when you get out in the sticks in this country. You know, you have to go to Wilmington for the federal court, and except for the post office. Well, there are more things now. There's a Social Security office, and you don't have much contact with the federal government, first of all. So I learned that. And I think what changed me was my exposure to state government and feeling like that the states were capable of doing things. I felt that Governor DuPont, I mean, it was a woman clerk of the House who hired me. She wanted a woman in that job. I mean, I never felt like I felt at that time the Republicans in Delaware were much more progressive, maybe, than the Democrats were, and that Governor DuPont had women cabinet secretaries. He hired the first black cabinet secretary in Delaware, appointed blacks to the bench. I'm trying to think if he appointed a woman to the bench, several women to the bench. So, I mean, I felt very at home, and I, you know, was fine. And the Republicans had hired me, and I felt I owed them some loyalty, and I changed my registration to Republican and got involved in Republican politics that way. Now, it's, you know, the Republican Party, as everybody knows, has changed a lot. But I guess I haven't. I think the Democratic Party's changed a lot, too. So that's how I got involved in Republican politics. And the Republican Party was always very good to me and very supportive.
You mentioned the fact that the Republican Party was quite progressive back in the 60s, 70s.
This would have been in the 70s and in
into
the 80s.
And that since then, I, you know, as you mentioned, people have talked about how it's changed a lot. And I, you know, and this is not to say in comparison to the Democratic Party, but just thinking about how the Republican Party has changed and the fact that you still, and I'll talk more about, or I'll ask you more about your own running for office, but to think about how you feel about the Republican Party today and the changes that you've seen in a way that kind of, and as you mentioned, you know, it kind of, as your civil rights passed, kind of shows your progressive views of that, but that the party seems to have become, at least certain aspects of it, more radical.
Well, I guess I would say, first of all, that there is an awful lot on the radical side of Republican Party that I personally agree with. An awful lot of the fiscal concerns, I think, are tremendously important. I think one thing that changes my way of thinking, I mean, first of all, I think there are a lot of progressive Republicans left. And I think even a lot of the people that you think are not progressive Republicans sort of are. I mean, you know, they still support women. I mean, our local representative that beat Rob is a woman. And she belongs to an evangelical church. But I don't think of her as being, you know, any kind of fanatic. I think another thing that's made a difference is that I really live among a lot of people who are right-wing Republicans that everybody else in the country seems terrified of. And I don't think I see them in quite the same light that the national press does or that the Democratic Party paints them as being. I see so many of them as being very concerned people who have been, have legitimate concerns about the level of crime, about what's going on in the schools, and I don't think they've had anywhere to turn. So I tend to be a little more sympathetic and not quite as judgmental, probably because I know a lot of these people personally, and I think some of them are very decent people. Now, I think a lot of them have had very little experience in politics. I mean, I come to it from a long experience in politics. A lot of these people have just gotten into it, and I don't think they've learned about compromise, and I don't think they've learned yet about having to appeal to a wider group. You know, they're so stuck on their particular way of looking at things, which I think is true in both parties at the extreme. So I tend to be maybe not quite as critical of the right wing of the Republican Party as a lot of people are, but I think the two groups have got to learn to get along. And I think there's probably, if they could just get there, that there's probably a lot more that they could agree on than not. But maybe I'm just deceiving myself. I don't know, because everybody tells me how terrible the right wing Republicans are. But I think there's a lot of truth in what they're telling us, especially about the fiscal situation in the country. And to some extent on some of the social issues. I think maybe some of their concern with some of the social issues has brought us back maybe to looking at it in a different way, which is maybe important.
And then stepping back in time, at least, to when you yourself decided to run for lieutenant governor. Can you tell me about that experience? Or was it right from working for Governor DuPont?
Uh-huh. I was still working in Governor DuPont's office. And they called me, Bill Manning, who was Governor DuPont's chief counsel, and I was working under, called me one day to ask me all sorts of questions about lieutenant governor and everything. And it finally dawned on me that he was asking me if I would be interested in doing this. And I couldn't believe it, because I had never expressed any interest in running for anything. It was like I told you at the outset, people come along and say, will you do this? And I say, sure. Probably if they'd say, will you jump out of this airplane? I would say, oh, that sounds like fun, and go do it. I don't know. So it just sounded like an interesting experience. And I talked it over with Robert, and, you know, there were lots of implications from that decision, because had I been successful, there was the thing about would I move on to do something else after being lieutenant governor. But we finally decided, well, it was worth the chance and I should take it. And I was running with one of the state's most popular politicians. So I did it, and it didn't work out, and that's that. That's history. But it was upsetting to lose. It was not fun at all. Not the least bit of fun. And it took me a while. You know, you had to sort of recalibrate your life. You think, well, I was thinking about, I was going to be lieutenant governor, and then I was thinking about running for something else. But that's not going to happen. So you have to start back and forget about that and start all over again in a way. So it wasn't fun to lose, but, you know, a lot of people do. More than 50% of the people who run for office lose. So you got a lot of company out there. As Robert says, if there were a self-help group for people who've lost elections, it would be a very large group. So that's what happened. And it was interesting. It was a lot of fun. I traveled all over the state, met a lot of people. I was just not well known at all. And because I'd just been a, you know, bureaucrat. I mean, I'd been assistant legal counsel to the governor, and that was it. And I didn't get out and about very much. I was raising two children at home. And so I was not very well known. And being from Sussex County was not helpful, because Sussex County isn't trusted a lot upstate. It's very hard for a candidate from downstate to be elected statewide. That's one thing you have to realize about Delaware. So there were a lot of obstacles, and I may have underestimated those obstacles when I agreed to do it. And actually, they thought the downstate, the Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor was going to be a woman from Kent County, and they were going to counter her with me. Well, she lost in the primary. So then I ended up running against someone from Newcastle County. So it was different from what they expected, and I'm sure they were sorry they had asked me to run after all this happened, but who knew? Who knew at the time I agreed to do it?
What was the campaign like? Did you experience any sort of the negatives of campaigning at that point?
Well, I was tired all the time, and negatives of campaigning, I don't think campaigning in 1984 was like it is today. Nobody was accusing me of any improper behavior, or, you know, I didn't have any of those negative attacks like you get today, or negative press. It was actually kind of fun. I went around, people had parties for me, and, you know, I was like a celebrity. The press covered me, they would call me and ask me questions, and, you know, it was kind of fun. And it was busy, and I hated not being here with my family more. My mother came in and took care of the children, so I could campaign at least the last 6 weeks or so. Now I look back at it as a really fun experience, except the end of it. That wasn't much fun, but the rest of it was wonderful. And I've always remembered on maybe 5 weeks before the election, it was Dorothy's 5th birthday, and it was on a Saturday. And Mike Castle said, "You've got to come with me to the University of Delaware football game so we can stand out and shake hands with people as they go into the game." And I said, "I'm sorry, Mike, I cannot do that. It's Dorothy's birthday, and I'm giving a birthday party for a 5-year-old. And he was just so upset with me for saying that's what I was going to do and not going to the game. And when I lost by 424 votes, it did occur to me that maybe I could have shaken that many hands that afternoon. I don't know. But no, I never regretted that decision. But I do remember that as one of the points in the campaign where I had a disagreement. I also had some disagreements with the Republicans in the state about gun control, because I guess I believe in some form of regulation of firearms, and they were pressing me to say, you know, I don't know what they were pressing me to say. This was before all the litigation in the Supreme Court about the Second Amendment and everything, but they were certainly pressing me to say I supported the use of firearms. And I was reluctant to do that. But other than that, I think, you know, it was a pretty happy campaign. Just wasn't successful.
Have you ever thought of running again for any office?
Well, I'm too old now to do that. And once I decided to become a judge and do the judgeship thing, that was out. I mean, when you're on the bench, you can't even pretend you know anything about politics. So, no. I had hoped Rob would be successful at his effort. That would have satisfied me a lot, but so it goes. Someday, a Robinson will win an election. Probably be Dorothy, who doesn't care a thing about politics. So...
Go ahead.
Yeah.
I was gonna ask when you mentioned the very particular instance in which you had to choose between shaking hands or
giving
having
a
Dorothy's
birthday party,
fifth year birthday party. Uh-huh. If that was ever in any part of your career, that kind of the challenges and the pulls of motherhood and family versus career and ambition. In developing a career, because I know for myself, I'm thinking about a path forward that hopefully allows balance of family life and career, but not wanting to sacrifice either at this mm-hmm. point theoretically, and how in practice that might play out or had played out for you.
Well, that was just the constant worry of my life, the constant conflict of my life, I think, of my whole career. Once I was married and once I had children. Which was more important, and they were always in conflict, it seemed to me. And the worst of it was that I never felt like I was doing either job very well. I always felt like if I had more time to give to the job, I could be a much better judge, I could maybe go farther in the judiciary. And then I would think, oh, if I just had more time with the children, it would just, make such a difference to them and to their development. So it was just a constant conflict. And there was always a struggle with childcare. I think I was lucky in that I did live in a small town and there were more people available to babysit and to help. Although I can't say any of them were trained nannies. You know, a lot of them were people who sat the kids down in front of TV or whatever. They weren't real good, although I had some very excellent part-time. But then they were always leaving. I was always having to find somebody else to take care of the children or find a preschool for them to go to. And that was just a constant problem. It was very bad, and we were lucky because Robert had so much freedom. Once the newspaper came out, he was freer, so he could like drive the kids to music lesson or pick them up after ball practice or whatever. When I got on the bench, I was not there. They could call me. I mean, I guess if they'd said your child has been rushed to the hospital, I would have stopped my hearing and gone to the hospital. But something like, you need to pick Dorothy up from Brownies this afternoon at 4:00, can't do that. I just couldn't do it on the bench at all. And then when I was working in the governor's office, I was in Dover. So just having the home covered, and I was just lucky that Robert was so available to do that and did it so willingly. I'm very indebted that he was just so willing to do that. And he meant a lot to the children. I think if we'd been divorced at that point, they would have both gone with him, chosen to go with him because he took so much care of them. But then, I also had some good babysitters who were here with them too. But I just remember that as being the worst problem of my life, is trying to balance that. I think at the outcome, I'll say I did a fairly good job. because I've had a very satisfying career, and I think both of my children have turned out just fine. So I guess I did a pretty good job, but it was a constant worry the whole time. Does that help you, Jane? Or does that make you decide you're going to forget law school?
I'm still hoping cloning becomes a possibility. At this point I can theorize how I might be able to do it all. But you know, it's going to be a challenge, and to know that I'm committed to the idea of having a family, and also committed to the idea of being a lawyer working for good in some manner.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I came to terms with it sort of after a while. I thought my career is satisfying. It's not the greatest. I'm not on the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm not on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. I'm not making $1 million a year, but it's satisfying, and you know, I have that satisfaction of doing something that is what I was trained to do, and that was good. And I think you just come to terms with it. And then my mother would always say to me, she was a very traditional kind of homemaker, but she would say, Battle, there's just nothing more important than your children. And you just are going to have to give up things to make sure they're taken care of. And I guess she's right, that my family and my children probably mean more to me than any judgeship that I could have attained. So looking back over 50 years, I'm not sure. When I started out, maybe I was a lot more ambitious, but now I feel more satisfied. That's one thing about being older. You kind of can look back with satisfaction on what you have accomplished and think you did it despite a lot of odds against you. What else can I say, Jane?
I wonder, this is a very specific, I suppose, memory question, but do you recall ever being a young lawyer fresh out of law school, or even in law school, and thinking about that, thinking about like the balance of career and family that would come?
You know, I probably thought about it, and I probably knew that I wanted to be married and have children. I think until you actually have children, you cannot imagine the challenge that is and the time it takes. You can envision, oh yeah, I'll work part-time, or I'll become this kind of lawyer because it'll give me time to be at home, and all that kind of stuff that you think is going to happen. But when then you get confronted with the reality of it, and it's so much harder than what you think it's going to be, because you just have these little people that are so dependent on you, and you love them so much, and it's just difficult. And other women, I think, probably handle it a lot better than I have. And my daughter seems more comfortable with it than I did. I guess part of my problem is that I grew up at a time when women didn't do what I was doing, so maybe that didn't give me the role models and the background I needed. You know, I still felt like I needed to spend a lot of time with my children because that's what my mother had done. So I don't know. That's probably, my age has a lot to do with that, because I do think young women today, I mean, Alex and Rob do a wonderful job with their children. You know, and they both have full-time careers. Now, Alice has sacrificed a lot, not only living in Georgetown, but just being a permanent clerk at Superior Court instead of going out and making her own way. And that's so she can have more regular hours. Of course, she's the most efficient person on the face of the earth anyway. She gets these opinions done. She makes the judge look awfully good, I think. She's a bright girl. So, but she's given up a lot. And I think to some extent Rob has too, because I think they both came out of law school and they would have been capable of, I don't want to say doing something more, but following a different course in a big city, which is what I thought they would do. And then they just decided they wanted to be in a smaller town. and to follow this kind of lifestyle. And so far they're fine, but I don't know. I keep thinking every time they leave to go visit her parents in Portland or her father up in New Hampshire, I think, oh, they'll stay. But they haven't yet. And I don't know what I would do if they did that, because I would miss those little boys so much. Yeah. And them too. So, no, I thought it was really tough, Jane. And I'm sorry to have to tell you that, that it's not going to be easy. But you'll do it. You know, you just do it. And just try not to feel too torn by it. Although I always did.
Yeah. Well, so. I mean, as you mentioned, it sounds like, you know, my mom worked when I was young, and I mean all throughout my childhood. And you know, having that role model, having that as being kind of the default, because I mean it's where how you grew up. I mean, to have that as a default, it's how Dorothy had the default. You know? And so I think you're right, it would make it a bit easier.
Make it, yeah. You have that role model. I can remember when Dorothy was little and people would say, oh, Dorothy, when you grow up, are you going to be a judge like your mother? Dorothy would say, no, I'm going to be just a mommy. And that would make me feel so terrible. You know? So, but she is glad to be back at work. She's had the baby. She was with the baby constantly for 3 or 4 months, and she was telling me the other day she's so glad to be back at work. So I understand fully that you go crazy if you're home with little children all the time. So you need to find that mixture, but it's a hard thing to do.
Yeah. And so,
well, it's harder than practicing law is finding that right mixture, I think.
Laws written in books, that makes it right.
Easy. Yeah, makes it easier.
Might be in, you know, tarot cards somewhere, but yeah. Not in a book.
And of course you don't know. You know, you might have children with special needs. It's just, you just don't know. You just don't know what life's going to throw at you.
And, you know, you've seen so many different situations like this in the work that you were doing.
Right, in family court you would just see horrible situations. And I felt so lucky that, you know, my family was as strong and good as it was. I remember one of the first times I took away a child from a parent, this mother came in. The mother was sort of mentally limited, and the child had been sick, and the mother couldn't give the child the correct medication. And the nurses that were going in were just very upset, and they just said, you know, you need to put this child somewhere where the child is going to get the medical attention that she needs. And yet you could just tell that this child was the center of this mother's life. And I finally ruled that the child should go with an aunt or something, you know, and then see the mother. And I remember the mother screaming, and I remember the child crying. I learned from that when I did orders to work out how the exchange was going to be. You don't just say, well, you take the child and go off and place her somewhere. You had to work that out. But I remember that was just the most awful experience. And I thought, if somebody had told me that they were going to take Dorothy away from me, I don't know what I would have done. You know, I would have been just like that mother. And it was just a horrible experience. And I went home and cried and cried and cried. It was one of the few times that anything just really got to me at family court. I saw a lot of stuff, but that one really bothered me. And it still bothers me. I think about it frequently. Because, that's an awesome responsibility to place in somebody, to say you're going to take their children away and put them in a foster home or something. And if someone had done that to me, I would have certainly hit them. Probably done a lot worse. And yet I did that every day, so it's hard to believe.
Speaking of that, did you ever have any security concerns living so close as you do to the family court?
They had a bomb scare one time, and they said there's a bomb in the building and it's gonna collapse the building on top of Judge Robinson. So we cleared out the whole building. Everybody had to go stand on the circle. And the bomb unit came in and they brought the bomb sniffing dogs. And because I live so close to the courthouse, they brought the bomb sniffing dogs here and went through my whole house and the outbuildings to be sure. And they called the school and had them take my children out of classes and everything. But that was about the only really bad incident. You know, people would make threats, and I had a couple of times when people kind of acted up in the courtroom. But nothing really bad, and the bailiffs all handled that. But I remember the dogs, the bomb-sniffing dog, being in my house. And they'd have to rest. The dogs could only work for about 30 minutes. I had never known this before, but they get so exhausted from this that they have to let them rest. So they would let them work for about 30 minutes, and then they'd have to rest for 30 minutes. And then they would resume. So having a bomb-sniffing dog go through a building takes a long time.
Should have that set up for lawyers.
Right.
Work really hard for 30 minutes.
Right.
But I need a 30-minute break.
And then, yeah, take a 30-minute break. Yeah. So, any other security incidents? I really can't think of any. No.
So I think I might have missed a step in the progression after the campaign and running for lieutenant governor. You worked for a couple years in private practice. Is that correct?
No, I just did. I took a year off because I had been working for a long time. And I did some brief writing, contract work for the different law firms around town, wrote some briefs. And then the judgeship became available on the family court, and I applied for that and was appointed to that. And I was the first woman judge in Sussex County, in this county. So that was a mark of distinction. But I don't know whether I told you this. When Rob was born, the Bar Association sent me a dozen red roses, and they said, to the first lawyer in Sussex County ever to have a baby. Because I was the first woman member of the bar here. They had not had a woman in 200 years be a member of the bar. And now, I guess it's half, 50% women. Good, too. They're good. So that has been a great source of pleasure for me, to see so many young women going into the law and what a good job they do. And there's a judge at the Court of Common, a woman judge at the Court of Common Pleas. But there's still no woman judge on Superior Court or Chancery. So, but anyway, it'll come because there are just so many women lawyers now, and they're so capable that they will.
So how did that feel as being the first woman? I mean, you know, you mentioned throughout law school and perhaps after that you didn't feel any sense of perhaps distinction as a woman in a group of women, or like, as you know, women lawyers being such small numbers. But here, was it very, when you were doing the things that you were doing, and were you aware? I imagine when you got the red roses, you were aware, you were the only woman lawyer to give birth in the county.
Right, in 200 years in the county. No, I mean, obvious that I remember these things so well is an indication that it was unusual. I was a bit of a curiosity, I guess. But I don't know. I just try not to think on those things too much. You know, I just try to do what I have to do and do the best job I can, and that's it. And not worry too much about the other things. Actually, I think being a woman has been very helpful to me. in the long run, because there were so few of my era, and then that coincided with the whole women's movement, so they were looking for women to place on different things, and so I think it was probably, on balance, it was more helpful than not. So I don't know. I had another thought about that, but now I can't remember what it was. It'll come back.
Oh,
I'm just talking and talking and talking. No. I think I'm so tired. It's just stream of consciousness.
Yeah, yeah. Do you want to
No, I'm okay. It's 3 o'clock. We can go a little while longer.
Sure. I'm wondering what the decision was like to apply for the family court position.
Well, there was a vacancy. And I thought by that time I had run for lieutenant governor, so I was pretty well known. I'd served on every bar association committee known to humankind, so I thought I'd have a pretty good chance of getting appointed, and I did. So I don't know that it was... In Delaware, you were appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, and you don't have to run for election. So once you knew that the governor and the party was kind of behind you, that you were going to have some political support in the legislature, I don't know that it was such a terrible decision. I just did it. But the thing that was the most worrisome is that I really hadn't practiced family law. I had had some family law cases. I was with a private law firm for 2 years before I went with the governor's office. And I had done some family law work then, but not a whole lot. So it was kind of, I was just kind of, again, just kind of thrown in and had to learn the ropes. And I didn't know any of the people at the courthouse or anything. So I had to just start on that career, and I did. And it took me a little while to feel comfortable, but eventually I did.
So. And you were there for about...
14 years.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Seems like 4 months. The years fly by when you get older. But it was interesting. And it was interesting. I've read these things about, you know, most judges take the first few years to get used to it, and then they sort of hit a peak, and for about 5 or 7 years they're really at their peak, and then after that they begin to slow down some, or they just kind of get into a rut a little bit. And I think that was probably true. That's kind of interesting. And while I was there, I got kind of involved in child support efforts. And so that was an interesting experience. That also has affected my political views. I got involved in child support at the national level, and I began to see, I mean, all the states had child support programs, and some were better than others, and some were just terrible. And when the federal government started writing regulations and requirements for the child support program, they directed all their efforts at the worst states, the states that just weren't complying. So all the states had to do kind of all these requirements because they were directed at the worst states. And I thought, that's not a good thing for a national government to do that. You know, that's another thing that makes me think so much should be devolved down to the states. And that kind. That's what I think about Medicare. That's what I thought about Obamacare. I thought Romney was right on target about Obamacare, that the states ought to be doing it with the cooperation of the federal government rather than the federal government taking that over. And I think a lot of the reason I feel that way is from my experience with the child support program, that it was run to correct the worst possible situations, rather than acknowledging that a lot of the states had effective programs. So that's colored my thinking to some extent.
Being a judge, what was it like to be a judge?
I loved it. I liked seeing the people, and I liked hearing the arguments, and I liked trying to figure out what meant the most to people, and I liked the process of coming to a decision. People would always want instantaneous decisions, but I always felt like I needed to take a little time to reflect on what I'd heard in the courtroom. So maybe I reserved too many opinions for a while until I'd had a chance to reflect on it. But I thought that whole deliberative process, I thought it was important to go through that rather than just saying, you know, at the close of the, well, I mean, a lot of hearings you can say how you're going to rule, a lot of the more minor things. But the major cases, you want to think about it a little bit. So no, I enjoyed being a judge very much. I like the whole process. I loved hearing the lawyers. I love hearing good lawyers at work. It's just amazing to see how and of course a lot of the cases I was hearing were not really big cases, but still it was. Sometimes I did have some major cases and got to hear some really really good top lawyers. But even just my run-of-the-mill cases were, it was interesting to see how lawyers work and how they approach their work. That was interesting to me. And I was telling somebody the other day about the necktie test. I didn't have much to stare at when I was in the courtroom except that picture of George Washington. And so I began noticing the neckties that the different lawyers would wear, because most of them were men. Sometimes they were women, whether they got... And I would, you know, I would see a lawyer come in and he would be all dressed up and have on a fresh shirt and a necktie. And I would think, you know, this case is important to this guy. I better listen very carefully. And I thought about that during the last days of the campaign when Romney was always wearing a necktie. I thought, this is really important to this guy. I better listen to what he has to say. So that's kind of a little funny aspect of my career as a judge. But no, I love seeing lawyers at work. And had a lot of admiration for them. And I would always tell them, these young lawyers would come in and they were so concerned about what law school they were going to get into or what their LSAT scores were. And I would always say to them, you know, I would say, not once in my courtroom have I ever known what law school anybody went to, much less known what their LSAT scores were. You know, what was important was the work they were doing on that case on that day. And just remember that, you know, that you can do it no matter where you go to law school or what your LSAT scores were. So, I don't know whether that comforted anybody, but I do think that. That a good lawyer is a good lawyer, no matter where they go to law school.
Did you have any instances of bad lawyering that saw? And how, knowing that oftentimes there are, you know, family rights in the balance, how did you deal with that?
Well, I had a couple of cases where I had to discipline lawyers. You know, because they were doing something that was improper, and that was troubling. Most of it was just kind of sloppy lawyering, but then the problem in family court is knowing that these clients don't have a whole lot of money, and they can't pay for the best lawyers, and they can't pay the lawyers they get for doing a whole lot of work. And so I had to remember that. It wasn't like they were all in there on some major case. You know, I thought most of the bad lawyering I saw was just kind of sloppy work and not very thorough work.
Did you, I know that you worked, you know, subsequently on drafting the Uniform Law Commission and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, as a judge, could you have any input on legislation or on mm-hmm. you know, the policies for family law, child welfare, that sort of thing?
I worked on, in fact, I chaired even while I was judge. Well, while I was a judge, I was on the Federal Interstate Child Support Commission. And then I chaired the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act Drafting Commission for the Uniform Law Conference. I wasn't drafting legislation specifically for Delaware. We were just drafting like a model act. And there are a lot of judges in that organization, and we all participate in the drafting process. And I didn't do it, you know, specifically for Delaware. I just did help draft the model act. And, of course, my experiences were relevant to that. Just because I knew how a child support case went through the courts. So that's helpful.
So I see a transition from civil rights to family and child mm-hmm. care. Was it, had you always been?
No, well, when I got to Southern Delaware, there wasn't just a major civil rights practice in Southern Delaware. There still isn't, if I may say. It's still a very conservative, very rural, and I suspect a lot of racial prejudice in the community. But I did not get involved in that. I got involved in state government and then transitioned over when I got on the family court, got involved in child support. And now I've moved down from child support into international law. That's what Robert was telling you last night. I'd become a famous international lawyer. Isn't this a hodgepodge of a career? Would you think I just would have done something and stayed with it, just joined a law firm and made lots of money and instead of just jumping around all these things?
Doesn't that sound boring?
Yes, it does sound boring. And my life has certainly been interesting, if nothing else. I got involved. How did I get? Well, it was through child support. The Bush administration decided they wanted an international treaty on child support. So different countries would honor each other's child support orders. And so then the question became, so they developed a treaty. And the question became, how would this treaty be implemented? Was the federal government just going to completely take over the child support thing and have it all done through federal law? Or was there a role for state law? So that was the interesting intellectual question there, because normally treaties are implemented through federal law if they're not self-executing treaties. So we said, well, we think this should be something that's implemented through state law because all the offices are state offices and the child support workers, you know, are more familiar with the state law than with the federal law. So let us try it. So we spent several years working on legislation that would implement the federal treaty through state legislation. And that's how I got into international law. So I did that. I actually went to The Hague twice, and which is the last thing I ever thought I'd be doing. And I've moved on beyond that now. We finished that model act, and that's out there. Some of the states have adopted it, but we're still waiting for the federal government to enact the federal legislation that has to go along with it. And now I've gotten into the Protection of Children Treaty, a 1996 treaty whereby the different countries are supposed to enforce each other's child custody laws. So that's what I was just in Washington 3 days last week, chairing a committee which consisted of like 32 lawyers for 3 days. It was worse than any trial ever. So that's what I'm involved in right now.
So not really retirement.
Not really retirement. I don't get paid for any of this, though. So it's all volunteer work. Oh, and the other thing I did recently, which was also interesting, the insurance commissioner appointed me to be the hearing officer in a merger between Blue Cross Blue Shield of Delaware and Highmark of Pennsylvania. I mean, I know zilch about insurance law. Absolutely nothing. don't know how, what the insurance commissioner's office even does. But I spent a year working on that. You know, I had to guide them through discovery and try to get them to come to a hearing. We had a terrible time finally getting the hearing. And then I had a 3-day hearing in that. Then I wrote a 90-page decision permitting the merger. So that was kind of controversial. And then the insurance commissioner adopted my recommendation.
Did you ever write a 90-page opinion in family court?
No, I don't think I ever wrote a 90-page decision. I wrote some long decisions and some complicated property divisions. But not a 90-page decision. I couldn't believe it was as long as it was. But it was a complicated case. There was a lot of factual stuff. You know, the Delaware Code says you have to consider all these factors. So you had to go through each one and say, this is what the evidence showed, and this is what I find. So it took 90, and just to set out the background of the thing took 20 pages probably. You know, how they had come about wanting to do this merger. So I did that all last year. I got that opinion out about exactly a year ago.
So you're still racking up the accomplishments?
I hope not. But the bad side of things is that as I've gotten older, I've developed some health problems, and that should have slowed me down, and maybe not as much as it should have. About 3 or 4 years ago, I underwent a heart valve replacement. I had been plagued by some kind of heart problem since I was a teenager, and I had terrible arrhythmia with my heart. And eventually, it just plagued me. I've often thought if I had not had that problem, who knows what I would have accomplished in life. But that slowed me down, and it was always a worry and a concern. I underwent a couple of ablations where they burned out part of my heart that was irritated and causing the bad heart rhythm. And then they finally said, you know, your valve is really deteriorated. You need to get that replaced. So I underwent that open heart surgery, and I came through it just fine, and so far it's been a real blessing. It is really taking care of that heart problem, and I think I've had more energy and more ability since I had that operation. And then last year, right when I was finishing up my 90-page decision, I went for my annual mammogram, and they discovered breast cancer in both breasts. In one, I had an aggressive tumor. In the other one, it was just going to develop into cancer. So in February, I underwent a double mastectomy. And fortunately, the cancer is a type that is of low risk of recurrence. So I've got my fingers crossed about that. But this is what happens to you when you hit your 70s.
Did you have a family history?
No, there had been no. I had always thought I was safe because I didn't know anybody in my who's had any form of cancer. And I thought, I'm, you know, genetically immune from getting cancer. So it was quite a blow to find that had happened. Although I have dense breasts with fibrocystic formations or whatever in the breast, and I just read recently that that's a higher indication of risk of breast cancer than family history. And I guess that's what happened to me, but it was a real blow. It was a total blow to learn that. And I agonized about it because they thought the one breast with the aggressive cancer could be treated with a lumpectomy. But the location of the spots in the other breast, they said it has to be a mastectomy. So I just decided it was having one breast removed, or I might as well have both. You know, in the interest of symmetry. So I went through that in February, and or the end of January last year. But I've made a pretty good recovery from that too. But I understand what's lurking out there. So, we'll see.
How does,
I tell my doctors they've saved me for Alzheimer's disease. Cure me of heart disease and cancer. The only thing left is Alzheimer's, and that's next. I don't know.
And how has that affected how you feel about the work that you're doing now and that you continue to do?
I think it's made me busier than ever, because I realize there's so much I want to accomplish and what little time is left. So I guess I'm not one to say, oh, woe is me, and take to my bed. I just keep going like the Energizer Bunny. So far that's the way it's been, and I don't know how long I'll be able to keep it up.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you've got some nice travel plans on the horizon.
I hope so. Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to travel a lot more than we do, but Robert's not very interested in it, so that's another reason I get involved in things here, I think, just to keep me involved. So, and I do other things. I took a course in Wordsworth last winter. I used to sing in the Southern Delaware Choral Society, and then I lost my voice, so I don't sing anymore. And, of course, I spend a lot of time with the grandsons, as much as I can. So retirement has been a wonderful part of my life. I've enjoyed it.
Sounds like there's a good balance there.
Right.
If you have work taking you to The Hague mm-hmm. and to D.C. frequently,
mm-hmm.
and then enough time to enjoy being mm-hmm. in this small town, mm-hmm. and if your grandson's a block away.
Yeah. No, I feel very, very fortunate. And I think people who look at me from outside think I'm very fortunate, too, and that I do have the kind of interesting work that keeps me busy, and that I have grandchildren so close by. So, and that I've come back from my health setbacks as well as I have.
In a way that it gives you something to fight against.
Yes. Right.
There's something that wants to take your time that you can actively say no.
Yes, exactly.
I don't want you to have any of it.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Your energy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I think that sounds like a good stopping place.
Okay.
I'll take